If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to this week's Government vs. the Robots, the fortnightly podcast that takes a look at how technology will influence politics in the future. I'm your host, Jonathan Tanner, and this week we've taken a trip to the Houses of Parliament to talk to Damian Collins. Damian is the MP for Folkestone and Hythe, but he's probably better known to listeners of this podcast as the chairman of the Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee. We sat down to talk about the committee's recent report into disinformation, why he doesn't have a lot of sympathy for companies like Facebook, how to make sure that Britain's electoral laws remain robust for decades to come, and whether social media is incentivising politicians to take extreme positions, and if it does, what can politicians do about that? You might find you need to adjust your headset just after the break in this episode, as we did have a small hitch with the sound gear that did put me into a bit of a fluster on the day. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Damian, thanks very much for having us here in the Houses of Parliament to talk to you. So much of what we've covered on Government versus the Robots falls under the auspices of your select committee. And I'm really looking forward to the conversation. But I just wanted to ask first off, it's a particularly intense time here in Parliament at the moment. Can I ask you to cast your mind back to the night you were elected as a successor to Michael Howard? And just tell me how excited you felt about becoming a Member of Parliament and what you were most looking forward to.
Yeah, well, it's an enormous privilege. And you've got the opportunity to not just represent your constituents, make a difference for the community that you serve, and but also, you know, you're part of our national parliament. You know, when I first stood for election to parliament, my view was, well, you know, if you're in parliament, rather than being someone who is just, you know, frustrated and shouts at the television when you see mistakes being made, you're actually part of the process. You have a vote and a say. So that's what's so exciting about being in politics, is the ability to change things, to make things happen. And we're living through a period at the moment where, you know, regardless of what people think about Brexit or the debate or where we are, you know, there's no doubt that Parliament matters. It's Parliament that's got to make a decision.
And when you reflect on the events of the last few weeks, is it playing out? Are you able to have the influence that perhaps you hoped you might be able to have as a Member of Parliament?
Well, you have a vote, and some of these votes are very finely balanced. I voted on Monday night for the Parliament to give him the right to set motions for the House to determine an alternative strategy to Brexit. You know, that was won with a majority of 27, you know, so not one vote, but nevertheless, you know, votes do matter, you know, and in a Parliament like this, where things are finely balanced, the way a small number of MPs vote can make a big difference.
Well, it's good to know that you're still enjoying it and still very much a believer in the power of parliamentarians to make a difference on the issues of the day. Recently, your select committee published its report into disinformation, which I think began life as the fake news inquiry and ended life as a disinformation inquiry. Can you sum up for us some of the findings of that report and what you felt were particular priorities that the government should be listening to?
Yes. Well, I mean, you're right. It started as an inquiry into fake news. What we realised during the inquiry is that fake news has become a somewhat debased term. So largely thanks to Donald Trump, but he's not the only one, where fake news gets used as an easy label for information that people just don't like or don't agree with, where what we were talking about really was the spreading of, in a malicious and deliberate way, of false information, disinformation, with a deliberate purpose. There's not people sharing stuff that happens to be inaccurate, but organisations that have a strategy to try and influence and persuade people based on sharing lies. And we felt that this should be seen as a form of harmful content, in the way that we regard, you know, extremist material as harmful, and or you know, for a business, copyright infringement is regarded as being harmful. In those situations, there are things we expect companies to do to act against that sort of content. And we thought the disinformation should be seen in the same way. But as we got into the inquiry, and particularly when we got into looking at issues like Cambridge Analytica, I think what became apparent to us, it's not just a content problem. It's not about identifying and removing harmful content. It's about understanding the systems that are used to make that possible and the way data is used, the way algorithms are used to direct people towards harmful content is something we've got to have an opinion about as a society. And I think we've got to be challenging the tech companies, not just when they make mistakes, but also over the ethics of the way they use their powers as well.
And if you're anything like me, which you may not be, but as you dive deeper and deeper into a subject, some things when you're looking for solutions tend to emerge as no-brainers, and other things tend to feel like they're knottier and may take longer to solve. As you went through the process on the committee, what were the first things that jumped out to you as kind of really obvious that they needed to be dealt with? And what are the things that perhaps, now that the inquiry is over, you still find yourself mulling over while you're thinking through the subject?
Yeah, there are. I mean, there are some really obvious things. So if you take elections in particular, one of the big areas of concern was the fact that the Russians ran adverts during the US presidential election targeting voters in America. And they've done similar things in seeking to interfere in politics in other countries as well, including the UK. The systems of the tech companies make that easy, and our electoral law makes that easy, because you don't have to identify who you are and where you're doing it from. So if I put a leaflet through your door in an election campaign, it's got to have some legal type on it that says who paid for that leaflet and who it's targeting. If I put an ad on Facebook to target you, I don't have to include that information, not by law anyway. Facebook are changing some of their own platform policies on that, but there's no legal requirement. So one of the basic things is to say, well, where we've got legal standards we apply in the offline world to make sure things are transparent and people understand who's sending them information and why that is, we should have the same standards applying in the online world as well. So some of those things, I think, are relatively easy wins. I think there are also issues which need to be resolved, and I think there's a clear reason for doing it. And that's to say that the tech companies, in certain circumstances, should be liable for the content that their users generate. And the reason for that is that they are not passive displayers. You know, they are curating what you see. If you go on YouTube, the next up function is directing you towards the next thing to watch based on its guess of what it thinks you're interested in. If you're on Facebook, the newsfeed is not an organic list of the things your friends most recently published. It is a curated list, can be curated by Facebook to try and prioritize the content it thinks you're most interested in. And also inserted in that is promoted content from advertisers as well. So if they're curating it, they've got some responsibility for it. And if bad stuff is posted there, harmful content is posted there, and the tech companies can see it, they should be required to remove it. And that's why, you know, we've talked about in our report ending the idea of platform neutrality, that they're just serving other people's content, they're not responsible for it, and actually saying there should be some legal requirements. So we don't rely on their community guidelines and policies, we set legal standards for what they should do. So for me, that in some ways is one of the basic principles that we're looking to apply to the idea of, you know, regulating content online, is the question of the responsibility the tech companies have. And also with that, the responsibility to report. You know, when they see bad things happening, they should report it to the authorities, even if it's just a suspicion. And again, the Russian adverts on Facebook are a really good example of this. You know, a Russian agency in St. Petersburg ran ads targeting voters in America during an election campaign. Now, that itself is a crime in America. The ads were run, supposedly went through the Facebook ad check team, and no one spotted them. And it wasn't until about a year or so later, when they were asked to go and look for this, that they found it. There have been suggestions as well that the company was aware of suspicious Russian activity on the platform even before the election itself. Now, if I was running a bank and I got suspicious, I'd seen suspicious activity, or I thought one of my customers was behaving fraudulently or laundering money through the bank, I've got an obligation to report it to the Financial Conduct Authority. Failing to do that could lead to me losing my license. There's jeopardy for me. But there's not for a tech company. So again, having requirements to report suspicions of bad activity on the platform should be there. And the ability of a regulator to go in and audit a company and say, well, you know, when did you first know this thing happened? You know, something like Cambridge Analytica, that happened. You know, when did you first know about it? And who alerted you within the company? And why wasn't more done about it earlier? Why didn't people know about it earlier? We don't really know the answers to any of those questions. There is supposedly an internal Facebook investigation going on, but we don't know the answers to it. There's no legal obligation for them to share that information. And that should change too. So I think in terms of transparency, looking at the way our own electoral law works, looking at the obligations and the liabilities and the responsibilities of the tech companies, these are all things that we can do. And I think we can set a legal framework for that and ask the companies to operate within it. And a lot of our recommendations are based around doing that. I think for the future, the harder issues are going to be, but really important, is the kind of ethics of technology. How do the companies use the massive power they've got? Do they use it fairly? Is it reasonable? You know, if I go onto YouTube looking for information about a vaccine and I just see a chain of conspiracy theory films, is that responsible use of technology? You know, and so I think these are the sorts of questions we're going to get into in the future. And we're going to need, I think we're going to need independent regulators and bodies that have got the ability to audit and investigate with inside these major tech companies to actually ensure that the standards we set are being followed.
We're talking in the weeks following the horrific massacre in Christchurch, and the attacker there chose to try and live stream the events that took place using different platforms. And I think the proposal you've set out of the difference between a platform and a publisher does resolve, or at least potentially legally resolve, some of the questions that have faced us for a while. But content on the internet always seems to find a place to live. Even if it doesn't live in kind of on Facebook or YouTube, there are darker corners of the internet. Do you think that it's possible to regulate those corners as well? Or are we just kind of prioritizing the big companies because that's where most bad stuff's happening?
Well, we give a special priority to the big companies because they serve the biggest audiences. So harm caused by someone posting content on YouTube or on Facebook can spread much more widely. And that's why I think it's reasonable we hold them to a higher standard for that reason. So the fact that the Christchurch massacre was broadcast for 17 minutes on Facebook live stream, I think we've got to really say to ourselves, if Facebook believe they couldn't have done anything else and that was the best they could do, that their best isn't good enough. So we need to, I think, you know, go into that company like that and understand, well, why did it take so long? What would you do if something similar happened again? What systems could you develop to make you more effective at spotting this? For content that's being uploaded by other users, you know, why wasn't it being identified earlier? Why wasn't more being done to prevent upload of known harmful material? And again, I think we need to have a relationship with the big companies where we can challenge them on that way based on facts and evidence from inside the organization. This sort of regulatory oversight is normal in other large, complex international industries. It's just the tech sector has developed so quickly that this hasn't developed alongside it. Now, you're right, there will always be dark corners of the internet that are hard to police. The first thing we can do is try to make those places as hard to find as possible. This has already happened with pirated content. I remember, if you go back, you know, 7 or 8 years, when this was a more live conversation with companies like Google, that they would say, well, you know, how can we regulate every website in the world? You know? But actually what you can do is you can look at the algorithms of your search engine and you can try and direct people away pirated content towards the stuff that is copyright protected. And they found ways of doing that. So if there are websites or online communities which are posting and sharing harmful content, then I think what we should ask the big companies is that they're not directing people there. It's hard to find through their servers and systems. We've also got to look at them taking more robust direct action against, you know, corners of the web that are homes of harmful content that seem to operate outside the law and are not interested in what we say. And then you have to look at site blocking and other things again to try and make that content hard to find. You're probably never going to create a perfect solution. And people that know their way around the web and the dark corners of the web will probably find a way of finding whatever they want. But that should not be easy to share. There should not be a closed Facebook group, sharing all this stuff without anyone checking what it's doing. That is a distinction I would draw.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com.
Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And with an organisation like Facebook, and I think Facebook take a lot of the flak, but actually Google and YouTube and Instagram and others have all face these issues and all have an impact on society. I've no doubt they're taking these issues seriously because they can affect the bottom line. Do you think that Facebook in particular, and maybe YouTube, are taking these issues seriously enough?
There's always the suspicion that they do the minimum, that they've moved in the last year because they've been under intense pressure to demonstrate that they've learned from the mistakes of the past. I don't have that huge amount of sympathy for them because most of the problems, particularly with Facebook, occur because of the way in which they design their platform to maximise ad revenue. So the issues around data sharing, the vulnerability of user data, are largely there because that's the way they make the money. And they've been more concerned about, the impression is that they're more concerned about that than they are. They're more concerned about making money than they are protecting user data. And they've designed the company in that way. For other things, it's a question about what do they invest in actually tackling harmful content themselves. Have they got enough people? They make a huge amount of money. Have they got enough people, humans checking content? Are they using technology to help make it easier for them to identify harmful content more quickly? Is that a priority area for them? Do they do enough to identify fake accounts, which are almost certainly the home to most of the more problematic content? And on Facebook, there shouldn't be any fake accounts, supposedly. So I don't think these are unreasonable challenges for us to have back to them. And I think what we need is an independent body or bodies that have got the right to go in and check. Because it would be an odd position if we've got our companies, which are effectively major utilities, which are an essential part of everyday life for millions and millions of people, that they are largely lauded themselves. And I think that's that is not acceptable, particularly when things go wrong.
And does that body exist already that could go in and check what's going on, or is it something we need to create?
I think it largely exists already. I think Ofcom already acts as a content regulator in broadcasting. They have a code defined by Parliament. They have a sort of day-to-day code of practice which they write, which evolves and can be updated depending on new practices and changes in technology. And I think we need something similar for internet content as well. No one says that we don't have freedom of expression on broadcast news in the UK. So the idea that trying to have some sort of standards being enforced online is just suppressing free speech. It's not. It's just saying we think there should be some basic standards, a duty of care that the companies have towards their users, and we expect them to meet those standards. And if not, there's a body that can do something about it. So it could be. So in my view, the content side could be done by Ofcom. The data side, data protection side, is already done by the Information Commissioner. What we need to do is give Ofcom in that situation proper powers, proper legal powers to go in, run investigations, demand access to documents, bring in press charges potentially if necessary.
And regulating big companies is one thing. Another place we've got already well-established regulation is on elections and electoral law. Your report said that electoral law isn't fit for purpose. In what ways is it not fit for purpose?
Well, it's not fit for purpose because the same standards that apply to offline communications aren't applied online. So the electoral regulation here was really written for a pre-internet world, let alone a pre-social media world. And therefore, the sorts of transparency around political communications that exist offline don't exist online. The other things we've got to consider is we ban broadcast advertising in politics, but we live in a world where for many younger people in particular, television as such doesn't particularly exist. They have internet-enabled smart devices which they watch audiovisual content through. And their favourite YouTube channel is just as much television to them as BBC One is. And some of that media is heavily regulated in terms of political communication. Some of that media is totally unregulated. And we need to think about that. What does that mean? And there's an immediate need, I think, to have transparency, to have information so at least who's running what ads. But in the RAM, we've got to think about what does our electoral law mean in a world where people consume news and information in a totally different way. For example, as well, people have freedom of speech in elections, but should they have freedom of reach in the same way? Does in the old days when delivering a leaflet or paying for press advertising required a substantial investment of time and money on behalf of the campaign, but if now you can reach millions of people really cheaply at the click of a button, what does that mean for our electoral spending rules? So I think, you know, there are some immediate things we need to get done. But in the round, I think we've got to see, we've got to recognise the fact that as people and communities organise themselves through social media and consume news and information in that way and consume advertising in that way, we've got to think about what political communication and campaigns means in a world like that. Our rules are just simply not written with that in mind.
And one of the things we know that political campaigners can do today is be hyper-targeted in the way that they go after people. And we're still living in the aftershocks of one democratic exercise in which there was a lot of hyper-targeted advertising. Do you think the ability to target individuals in a sort of in a way that's psychologically and psychographically profiled potentially swung the referendum outcome?
I think if you look at the campaigning in the referendum, and I think it's rather similar to the Trump campaign as well, that DJ used similar agencies and similar techniques. I think it's what the campaigning does is it seeks to not necessarily persuade people of one opinion or another. It targets people that are already sympathetic to their point of view and changes the way they behave. So it turns someone who is, you know, passively interested in an issue to someone who's actively interested in it, who's actually campaigning, propagating the message to their friends, and will certainly go out and vote. And if you look at the investment, both in the Trump campaign and the referendum, there's a big investment in the last sort of 48 hours of the campaign. There's a big push there, which to me suggests that it's being used a lot as a sort of big turnout of the vote effort. And I think it's probably highly effective. I mean, one of the common hallmarks of both those elections is high turnouts and highly differential turnouts as well. And there was some evidence we referred to in our interim report, which is an internal piece of work Cambridge Analytica did, looking at some of their political work in America. And again, what they were demonstrating to potential clients they were pitching to was that they managed to drive much higher levels of turnout amongst people that have been targeted. So to me, that's clearly what they clearly believe is effective and clearly what they're doing. You know, should people be allowed to do it? I think, again, people who are being targeted in this way should have the right to know who's doing it and why they're doing it. They can then weigh that up as to whether they believe that message or not. But I think there's also an interesting legal issue here we look at in the report, which is about consent. Now, under the European GDPR rules, you have to give informed consent for political information about you to be gathered and used.
In Europe, under the GDPR rules, there are certain protected characteristics of data. That relates to people's political views, sexual orientation, religious beliefs, ethnicity. And there's a really big issue, I think, around targeting people through social media with these targeted ads based on psychological portraits of people. Is have they given their consent to be targeted in that way? If I've set up a Facebook profile and I've deliberately not said what my political views are when I've been asked, but yet what Facebook can do is guess what they are and make that data available to someone else to target me with advertising, then is that legal? You know, if I'm targeted by, if someone's gone to Facebook and said, I want a lookalike audience for this group of people who are my known supporters, and they give my data to contact users of Facebook based on their assumed political orientation, and they're targeted, micro-targeted in that way, is that legal under GDPR? And I think it sounds like it's a pretty technical question, but actually it's quite an important one about the use of inferred knowledge from data in political campaigns and whether people have given their consent to be targeted in that way. And actually, ethically, should we be selling politics in the same way we sell cars and clothes online? You know, should there be different rules? And I think these are really important questions for the future.
And you mentioned GDPR, which is European legislation. And I think just today, the European Commission has said that it will be enforcing copyright laws against big tech companies as well. These pieces of European legislation obviously may well not apply in Britain post-Brexit. Do you think that that's an opportunity for Britain to kind of lead the way on regulation of tech companies, or is it a threat to British citizens in an environment where we're probably due to have more electoral volatility than we might otherwise have had?
Well, the intention of the government is to comply with GDPR rules. So we share what they call data equivalence with the rest of Europe. I think they're basically going to be, in the Western world, two standards. There's the European standard and there'll be the American standard. I don't think there's the role or the room necessary for the UK to develop a sort of a third way. And I think, you know, we may see some of these issues differently to other Europeans. But I think one of the reasons people in America in particular are quite interested in the debate we're having here is that I think, you know, we're more like them, but nevertheless, we're part of the European framework. And
a lot of people in America who know how hard it is to legislate on anything at all, let alone on something like this, are interested in the debate in Europe and see, well, maybe European norms, which provide more power to the individual over the big tech companies, maybe those will become the sort of global norms for the Western world. And I certainly think, you know, we can't lose sight of the fact that people do have rights, and you know, that people running companies that are gathering data have got certain rules they have to follow in how they use that data, the consent they've had to use it, and what they do with it.
And we've spoken to an organisation called Who Targets Me on Government versus Robots, who look at who's buying adverts and targeting you on Facebook and elsewhere on the internet with them. And they are wondering about the role that dark money is playing in politics at the moment. So a lot of politicians who are campaigning, they may not have relationships with people who are using opaque funding for political causes, but they benefit from those political causes. So what prospects are there for us to really update electoral law when most of the people in charge of doing that updating are benefiting, perhaps vicariously, but benefiting nonetheless from dark money in political advertising?
Well, I think this is also about looking at not just transparency, but what we regard the electoral period as being, which is traditionally just being the short campaign, you know, the 5 weeks or so, or it's a bit longer than that before the poll itself. But, you know, we've seen evidence during our inquiry of organisations running adverts. No one knows who's doing it. There's either no information about the organisation, or there's just a brass plaque. There's a name of an individual. There's a registered company that they're linked to, but there's no accounts. There's no information, no idea where the money's coming from. It's really easy for a wealthy person that wants to give money to support a political idea and have that money spent through proxies and to reach a big audience online is a really easy thing to do. And I think we should be taking more of an interest, you know, when people are spending significant amounts of money into who's doing this, where the money's coming from, because it's open massively to exploitation. It maybe has been for a long time. And if people are using this sort of campaigning to run dark ads targeting people individually, then, you know, unless you happen to send it to someone that might not want to receive it or takes issue with having received it, a lot of this wouldn't even be observed. No one would know. And so I think, you know, the platform changes that Mark Zuckerberg has talked about with Facebook should give us cause for concern here as well. If the new model for Facebook is going to be, you've got a bucket of data that's associated with you, it's linked to your Facebook profile, but is also connected to WhatsApp or other encrypted messaging channels, you can still be targeted in just the same way with advertising, but every ad effectively becomes a dark ad then, and not even the company it's hosting it, so they can see. You know, so we're just opening up this massive network that can contact, you know, billions of people around the world, and we, in addition, we're told, well, no one can see what's going on, no one's got any responsibility for what's going on, we don't know what people are receiving. You know, that's got to be a big worry.
And just changing tack slightly to think about the kind of some of the politics behind all of this in a different way. You've talked a bit about online harms, and there's a ledger of online harms which the Centre for Human Technology keep. Those harms feel to me, when I look at the list, they're very much they tap into a lot of what it is to be human. Mm. And I wonder whether the politics of dealing with tech require us to focus on kind of issues of what it is to be human as much as issues like the NHS and education and abstract political issues. Do you think that this is an area in which politicians and politics has to get involved in humanity and be a bit more human about conversations?
Yeah, I do. And I think that's why I talked earlier on about the sort of ethics of technology and actually taking a step back and saying, you know, is that right? You know, is directing people to content that is misleading and harmful the right thing to do? You know, is if that is based simply on an algorithm selecting and guessing, you know, preferences for you, but nevertheless, that's the journey it's leading you on, is that responsible? And I think these are harder questions, because I think what the tech companies like is the certainty of either being told there are no rules in this space, you can do what you like, or saying in this incident there is a law and you can't, and this is what you've got to do to abide it. What they don't like doing is exercising judgment about what others are doing. Now, I can understand that if people are posting content, they don't want to be seen to be the policing the entire platform. But nevertheless, they have a responsibility. You know, and certainly, they do have a responsibility to police the more extreme and more harmful sorts of content. I think they do have a responsibility to use the powers they have responsibly and to look at algorithmic bias and other things that may operate in their systems that they didn't design in, but nevertheless have become a feature of the way they work.
And I was on Twitter while we were preparing for this interview, just looking at Full Fact, and looked at whether the Brexit March actually had 1 million people on it. And Full Fact is an organisation we've had on the podcast before. And they said, no, no chance was their conclusion. And the thread beneath it had lots of people who I'm sure would be very convinced that they don't succumb to fake news or disinformation. Absolutely adamant there must have been 1 million people on that march. And where I'm going with this is asking whether there is a temptation for politicians who recognise that politics is very emotional these days, and that emotion wins out over facts and rationality in most political debate in the UK at the moment, it seems, especially if you spend too much time on Twitter. Is the temptation then not to a politician who wants the reins of power to polarise people further because the incentives are stacked towards taking polarising positions?
Well, I think the danger is it's an interesting question, which is, would a politician in that environment, do they seek to play to extreme audiences, or does the system encourage them to do that? You know, because the way information is shared, you know, through social media, when it spreads quickly, it's spreading through people who are of a like mind. You know, so in some ways, the slight danger would be that the algorithms could train politicians to play to set audiences rather than seeking to appeal to a broader sweep of society, and that their reward, you know, their judgment of their reward is engagement on social media. But actually what they're not recognising is they're not necessarily reaching a wider pool of people. They're just reaching more people that think the same thing. And that is something we should be concerned about, is actually whether the increasing polarisation of debate in politics is actually being driven by the way social media works and the reward people get for taking up more extreme opinions. The Facebook algorithm really notes is engagement with an issue. So someone could post something and they get loads of really negative comments, but Facebook doesn't necessarily distinguish between people that love it and people that hate it. So in some ways, the most effective thing you could do if you wanted a big audience on Facebook is to be as controversial as possible, and it will reward that.
And it strikes me that some politicians have noticed that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
And I wonder what we can do to encourage those politicians who don't want to polarise people, because the algorithms are stacked against consensual politics. And that feels to me like a big question of our times.
Yeah, and also they're normalising behaviour. So a politician or a journalist, even if they've got extreme views, they will stop short of saying really outrageous things. But then, never step by step, they're normalising bad behaviour. You know, dismissive language, maybe language that could be considered abusive, that targets particular minority communities, that every time they get close to that line, they're normalising a certain pattern of behaviour that will encourage other people to go further. And that's why we should all be really concerned about this.
And I always try and end an episode on an optimistic note. So in all the inquiries you did, and ending on a moment of great concern, what have you seen during the inquiry into disinformation that gives you cause for optimism that we can reshape public debate and make things less polarised and perhaps a bit more consensual and civil?
Well, I mean, people have access to more information than they've ever had. You know? So the ability of people to inquire and ask questions and gather information, to contact people in a positive way, to build interesting campaigns behind issues they care about, has never been easier. So all of that is a really positive thing. But what we have to recognise is these same tools that can do good can also do bad as well. And I think we've been slow in recognising and understanding the way some of these tools can be exploited. But ultimately, what we've got to do is, if we want to appeal to people with better nature and better instincts on important political ideas, we've got to get the information out to them as well, and be quicker than the bad people and call out the bad stuff when it happens too. And that's, I always think that transparency is a great disinfectant.
Damien Hines, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all from Government vs. the Robots this week. Hopefully you've enjoyed the episode. As ever, if you've enjoyed it, please do tell your friends about it. You can follow us on Twitter at @govt_vs_robots. My thanks to Sky Redman for her help with the editing and production of this podcast, and we'll see you again next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.